terrific. Have you had a chance to read the book or look at it?
Certainly have, and one of the reasons I'm interested and wanted to talk to you very much was that obviously Rupert Murdoch is a major influence in the United States, as well as in Australia and in Britain. And obviously he has had very bad press over here. But I wanted to go back a little bit. I want to find out a little bit about you and the events leading up to, I know you were working on the editor of the Sunday Times, but tell me a little bit about you, how you landed in that job and the events that led up to your becoming editor of the Times itself.
Okay, do you want me to start now?
Yes.
Oh, great. I started in journalism at the age of 16 as a reporter, and then after 2 years on a weekly newspaper reporting, I'd learned to do shorthand and typing at the age of 15. I went in the Royal Air Force. After 3 years, went to the university on the GI Bill, as it would be in the United States, took a degree in economics, went to the Manchester Evening News as a sub-editor, then became a political reporter, feature writer, foreign correspondent, leader writer, the usual variety of jobs that a newspaperman gets in Britain. And then I got a Harkness Fellowship to the United States, and I went to Chicago University. I traveled for 2 years through the United States reporting on segregation in the South. I worked with Jonathan Daniels on the News and Observer in North Carolina.
When was this?
1956.
Well, that was almost at the height of the Civil
War. Yes, it was Brown. Supreme Court had just gone through. I visited the people who started the White Citizens Councils, the respectable front of the KKK. And I visited the bravest man I ever met was in, bravest journalist I ever met was a P.D. East in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, who ran a satirical paper making fun of the Deep South and white segregation from Mississippi. He had a bomb thrown through his window, but he kept on putting out this petal paper, enormously funny paper, which later on I discovered a friend of mine, Sid Perelman, was greatly amused by. I never met P.D. East, and I don't know what's happened to him. Hazel Brandon Smith in Lexington, Mississippi, who later won a Pulitzer Prize. And then I went across the United States visiting, I looked at Indian reservations.
Let's go back for a second. What was your reaction as you traveled through the South during this turbulent era?
That the majority of the population, the majority of the whites, were worried and hostile to the civil rights moves of equal education. Some of them who were more liberal thought that it would have been wrong to take education as the first break in segregation, that it would have been better to take something less emotive anyway. But there were a few minority of whites that I met who were determined to try and do everything they could, people like Hazel Brandon Smith, and I was impressed by their bravery. I also went to see Carter in Greenville, Mississippi, Hodding Carter, and what struck me very forcibly was the influence that a small but morally purposive newspaper could have in the community, and what a few outspoken and brave leaders could do. That's what struck me most impressively.
Isn't it interesting that after years of resistance to integration in the South, over a period of 20 years, 25 years or so, there has been an easing of the racial tensions and what appears to be an almost complete integration in the South. Isn't it interesting that so much seemed to have happened in so little time?
I know. It's looking back on it, it seems to now to have happened quite quickly. But I think that when I was there in 1956, I think the tide could have swung differently if those people that I've mentioned and those newspapers that I've mentioned and others hadn't given the leadership that was given. The Southern Council also, I've forgotten the exact title of it, which used to collect together all the evidence, and the Louisville Courier Journal, which also gave a great lead at that time. I think that the South has a great debt to those people who channel the forces in a benevolent direction rather than let them slip into a kind of malign hostility. In other words, if you'd had demagogic, racist leadership throughout the South at that time, I think that we wouldn't be where we are today and there'd have been a lot more misery.
England is having an increase in racial problems right now, isn't it?
Certainly. It's the familiar syndrome which you've had here. Blacks from the West Indies, families break up very easily. because of their attitudes to marriage are not as stable. So you get a lot of children brought up by the mothers alone, and leave school early, relatively less well educated, and so on and so on, the usual cycle of unemployment. But it's very unfair, of course, to identify the blacks as the source of crime. There are some pockets of London where there's a predominance of black crime, but as a percentage of the population, the blacks are no more responsible for crime than the whites, and if you include the Asians, the browns, in it as well, in fact, they're somewhat more law-abiding.
I think I got you off the track a little bit because we were in the United States in the 1950s and you were heading out to some Indian reservations.
Mm-hmm. Well, Indian reservations, I visited the Navajo and the Hopi reservations and I talked to the Bureau of Indian Affairs later. I was interested in how the Indians were being treated in America, partly because I'm romantically interested in the West, and so that's why I visited the West, really. Then I finally ended up back at... I went to Stanford University in California to put some... academic meat into this travel sandwich, and then after 2 years went back to Britain, did a master's thesis, went back to the Manchester Evening News, became the deputy editor of that paper, and then curious things, odd things in life, I was asked to give a course in editing to India, to Indian journalists, the first course that the International Press Institute had ever attempted. So for 2 weeks in India I took leave from the newspaper work and tried to discuss headline writing and story writing with Indians. It was a wonderful experience, a tremendous excitement. But one of the other people on the course was connected with the Westminster Press, and when a vacancy became for an editorship in the Westminster Press, I think I got it on the basis of what I'd taught the Indians rather than anything else. So I became the editor of the Northern Echo in the northeast of England at the age of 31, a daily paper, very similar to many American papers, and I think my stay in America influenced me greatly in my attitude to that paper. It had 99,000 sale when I went there.
I'm sorry, it had what?
A circulation of 99,000 when I went. When I left, it had 114,000. It spread over a very large area, two English counties and a couple of cities, or equal to a small American state. And it was a morning paper competing against 9 national dailies produced in London and Manchester, 3 regional mornings, and 2 or 3 evenings. So intense competition in the northeast of England, where most of the readers were coal miners and industrial workers, but with in the south a belt of farmers and gentry. So it was a fascinating social market to reach. And I enjoyed that enormously. I did. Took from my American experience a zest for investigative journalism and campaigning, and campaigned about air pollution and many other things. The most interesting one, in a way, was that I campaigned for a pardon or an inquiry into a man who had been hanged for a murder he didn't do. It's the famous Evans Christie case, no relation to me. There was a mass killer strangling women and babies in London, and the murders were committed by a man called John Reginald Halliday Christie, who was a necrophiliac, who was a policeman who had a lodging house. But before they got round to realising that it was Christie who did the murders, they hanged a man called Timothy Evans for them, who was completely innocent, who was framed by Christie. And I had a campaign from the northeast to raise concern and to have an inquiry to prove that Evans didn't do the murders. And after a year of campaigning from the northeast of England, I got a national inquiry by the government into the Evans hanging.
Too bad it came so late.
Huh?
Too bad it came so late.
Well, it came too late to save Evans, but it did two things. It came at the moment England was discussing the death penalty, and the inquiry resulted in a free pardon, posthumously, as you say, for Evans, and that coincided with the big debate in Parliament on the death penalty, and the death penalty was abolished in Britain as a consequence.
So you were almost responsible for that.
Well, I was one of the forces. Don't forget, in my campaign for Evans Christie, there were had some very important allies and partners, and the newspaper was the medium of expression for them. So I felt proud about that, and it was during that time that Dennis Hamilton, the now Sir Dennis Hamilton, the editor-in-chief and the genius of the Sunday Times, who with Roy Thomson, the Canadian millionaire, had really made the Sunday Times into a culturally and politically significant newspaper, asked me if I'd come and work with him as a managing editor in charge of news. So after 5 years on the Northern Echo, which I loved, I, for the first time, entered London journalism. I'd always been a provincial editor, really, provincial journalist. And in 1966, I became the managing editor of the Sunday Times. Oh, and another campaign I'd done in the Northeast, I carried to the Sunday Times, which was in Britain at the time. Women were not examined for cervical cancer. There were no screening of women for early detection of this disease. And I read a paragraph while I was in the States about the screening programs that were available in British Columbia. And so I sent a report around the United States and Canada and London and Britain, talking to cytologists who read cells. And as a consequence of that, I succeeded in getting a national screening program while I was in the Northeast. But it was too limited, and so when I arrived at the Sunday Times, Dennis Hamilton agreed that I could continue my interest in this medical program. And we got the program really national, applying to all women, rather than the pilot program I'd succeeded in obtaining while I was editor of the Northern Echo. So I had a taste for trying to get things done through newspapers on the basis of as many facts as one could discover. And I did the sports pages for Dennis Hamilton. I did the news pages. And after 12 months there, I was extremely lucky in career terms because Roy Thomson, the wonderful Canadian millionaire who owned the Sunday Times, who incidentally didn't make a made his fortune after the age of 60.
He made his fortune after 60?
After he was the age of 60. He was a relatively man of modest means until he was 60. Roy Thomson wanted to buy the Daily Times. Now, the Daily Times and the Sunday Times are very different newspapers, both serious papers covering politics, the arts, and foreign affairs in an entertaining way, but seriously. The Times, the famous paper of record, the oldest daily paper, but losing money. The Sunday Times, a big profit maker, the most profitable newspaper in Britain, with all the journalistic innovations, the first colour magazine, the first separate review section, commonplaces now, but innovations when Roy Thomson and Dennis Hamilton introduced them. And so they were making profits. The Daily Times, owned by the Astors, was losing, and so Roy Thomson bought the Daily Times, got the approval of the Monopolies Commission, and the two papers were set up with guarantees of editorial independence. Now, that was no more than a continuation of what Thomson had practiced. He'd always practiced editorial independence. And so in 1966, Dennis Hamilton, the editor of the Sunday Times, became the chairman of the whole company and the editor-in-chief of both newspapers. And I became the editor of the Sunday Times, succeeding Dennis Hamilton. And that the story from their story goes then from 1967. What I was editor of the Sunday Times was for 14 years, which I was a tremendous, wonderful period for me because I'd always worked either as my own reporter, investigator, commentator, or with newspapers with no resources. And the Northern Echo was a profitable paper, but not hugely rich. But the Sunday Times is a very profitable paper, brilliant journalists on it. And so we were able to achieve a great deal with Thomson's freedom, with the profits of the paper being used for better journalism the whole time, making, incuriously enough, as you will know, as the paper got better, the profits got bigger, so we were able to do more and more. And the tragedy of... I've told some of the stories in good times, bad times, as you know, but the tragedy of those years is towards the end. The trade unions ruined it all.
We obviously are not going to have time to cover everything we'd like to, but so we're going to have to skip a little bit and move ahead. What were the conditions that led to the Murdoch takeover of the Times?
In the late 1970s, the government had a pay policy, which meant that firms should not give any pay initially or limit them to a small percentage to the workers. Some employers found ways around this legislation. Roy Thompson decided, and the management, that we would, and Ken Thompson, that we would stand by it. And so this led to more unrest in the print factory, which is called a newspaper. British print unions are very, very powerful, very obstructive. They resist new machinery. They stop work almost every day to ask for some new payment for something. Somebody said they get paid to come to work, and when they're at work, they want extra payment for every bit of labor they do. It's not unfair to say that, and although I liked and worked with many of the printers very happily, their leadership was extremely greedy and without a care for the paper more and more. So the Sunday Times lost hundreds of thousands of copies by sabotage and guerrilla strikes by the print workers for extra pay. And every time management tried to be more efficient, we had hundreds and hundreds of people we did not need. Every time we offered them handshakes or whatever, or tried to have some attrition when somebody left, more disruption. And when we tried to introduce, and nobody has yet introduced in Britain, journalists having access to the keyboard for the computer. No journalist can touch a keyboard computer in Britain to this day. We had more trouble, and for 12 months, the Sunday Times and the Times were off the streets for 12 whole months, and that at a cost of 40 million. And when we came back, the unions had promised to behave because they won, and they were given more money. They lost a few of the restrictive practices, but not many. No sooner were we back, the very first week, the Sunday Times was 200,000 short, and on it went. And so finally Thompson said, to hell with this, I'm going to sell. The trouble was that he didn't sell to the people he should have sold to. I mean, when I say he, it was really the British leadership of Thompson had bids for both the Daily Times and the Sunday Times from management. I led a management buyout team for the Sunday Times. And just like Jim Hogan in Chicago, I raised the money. I got I was going to continue as chairman of the paper, which I had been doing for some time, and we'd been very successful. My general manager was going to stay as the general manager. He was the finance director for the company. And I had a third person, Bernard Donoghue, the former advisor to the Prime Minister on economic matters. And we raised the money, but they wouldn't sell to us. They sold to Rupert Murdoch. And to this day, I do not understand it.
Well, Murdoch took over the paper, but you stayed.
Yeah, I stayed. the choice was to stay and hope and believe that what he'd said would happen, because one has to remember that in Britain there was a very strong monopolies legislation. There was an outcry that Rupert Murdoch, who already owned the largest selling Sunday newspaper and the largest selling daily paper, was about to acquire the largest selling serious Sunday paper and the most famous title of all the Times. It was a complete extension of monopoly and should have been referred to a commission, which would almost certainly have ruled against it, and then we would have had the paper. But the government, Mrs. Thatcher, and the responsible minister, as I show in my book, fiddle the figures to suggest that the Sunday Times was losing money, which was a lie. And with that as one arm, with the other arm, Rupert Murdoch said, look, I'll own the papers, but I won't have any influence on them because I promise not to interfere politically. I promise to give the editor a budget so he'll have the freedom he had under Thompson. I promise not to give instructions to journalists myself. I promise to keep the titles in this company, and I will go to prison if I break any of these promises. The story of my book is the story of how systematically Rupert Murdoch broke every single one of his promises. And the story since the book came out is the government's refusal to do anything about it. I mean, a shame-faced sort of bury our heads and hope this noise made by Evans will go away. And why did I take the job at the Times, or why did I stay on in the company? Well, if Murdoch had been an honourable man and not a liar and a cheat, then it would have been the same as working for Thompson. The ownership wouldn't have mattered, but of course, since he was not an honourable man, it was a mistake.
What kind of personal relationship did you develop with Murdoch during this period?
Well, he's a man of infinite charm, and in the first 6 months, the Times had been losing sale and losing a lot of money, and it needed certain improvements in the news area, and needed stiffening, and it needed to improve its authority in foreign reporting, and it needed some developments. And every time I tackled these, he supported me. I mean, if I needed, for instance, I decided to print the university results from all over Britain, and not just from the Oxford and Cambridge. And that it is not just from two universities, but from all the universities. Ridiculous just to choose Oxford and Cambridge, because that's a representative of a kind of snob elitism. And that needed extra pages, and he said, go ahead, you know, don't think about that. I'll provide the resources, you just get on with it. So for the first 6 months, I got on very well. He's not a very easy man to get on with, because he's a man of very short temper in private reality, although the public persona is always one of relaxed charm. But I can't criticize those first 6 months. I was very happy, working very hard. The second 6 months became increasingly ominous, because more and more he interfered. He kept promising me the budget which I was entitled to would be given to me, but he never did. And then he interfered in all the decisions, said I couldn't hire anybody, that any expenditure of a certain level had to be approved. Well, if you know a newspaper operation, you cannot have freely run a newspaper unless you can decide how you spend the resources you're entitled to. If you have a budget, say, of 5 million, you might decide to spend 1 million on sport and 3 million on foreign news, whatever it may be. Or you may decide to redeploy the staff, or to have fewer people but more highly paid. There are many, many ways in which the newspaper's decisions are profoundly affected by the way the editor chooses to dispose of the resources. Well, Murdoch wanted to have a controlling say over this with his managing director, which were interference in editorial matters. For instance, another small matter, he wanted the United States to be reported through his Australian bureau rather than through an independent Times person. Anyway, all those stories are told in the book, or some of them. But the important factor was that in the second 6 months, relations got very jagged and strained, because in Britain at that time, pre the Falklands invasion, the Conservative Party was absolutely desperately low in the polls. Mrs. Thatcher was at the lowest state in the polls in the history of opinion polling. The Social Democratic Party, led by Roy Jenkins, Shirley Williams, David Owen, Bill Rogers, was riding high, was sweeping, taking seats from the government in all the by-elections which occur in Britain when somebody dies. And so the government was in the right wing of the Conservative Party in a state of total panic, because in addition to all this, the left wing of the Conservative Party, the liberal wing, was in revolt against Mrs. Thatcher. And the high unemployment caused by excessively high interest rates and monetarism applied very severely, a policy which has now been abandoned in the United States, at least. And the Times was critical of monetarism and gave a fair report to what the Social Democrats were saying, and Murdoch got increasingly angry about this. And I suppose he felt a debt to Mrs. Thatcher, who fiddled the law to get him the papers. And we got to the situation It's like a Hollywood farce, really, in which I printed an article by Tobin, the Nobel Prize winner in economics. The day he got the award, we asked him what he thought about the conduct of Britain's economic policy. I had no idea what he was going to say. What he said was highly critical. "Why did you print that article?" said Murdoch. "Well," I said, "it's timely." "What does he know?" I said, "Well, he's at least a Nobel Prize winner." "You know, intellectual bullshit," he said. And we had this kind of scrap. He wouldn't engage in an argument. This, you know, you, 2 points here, what about this? He says, all an assertion, lunges, colliding assertion. "What do you do, print, print?" So very unsatisfactory and deteriorating relationship. Because I liked discussing economics, and we discuss it all the time in the editorial floor of the Times.
Well, Levin, so let's move on. Tell me about those final moments when you decided to pack it in. How did that come about?
Well, Rupert Murdoch asked me to resign. I said I refused to resign. He'd been looking around for excuses and causes. He tried to paper the files that I was overspending, which was a smear and an outrageous lie because of the budget point I'd made. He tried to suggest that the paper had no stand on issues, which again I'd demonstrated was not a runner. And so he said, "Well, the staff is divided." Well, he had divided the staff by, not divided them, but caused disruption among the staff by saying the paper was about to close in a week's time. The morale was extremely low. He said, "We're going to close this paper because of the print unions who were acting up again." So at that moment, he said to me, he wanted my resignation, and unknown to me, he'd offered my editorship to the deputy editor of the paper, whose family motto is "True to the End," Charles Douglas Hume, a nephew of a former prime minister, who had said to me at the beginning, "You and I will support you in a fight to keep the Times independent of this monster Murdoch. He is a wrecker of institutions." Because what was happening was that he was a Murdoch person, or became a Murdoch person. I don't think he was at the beginning. And so we had him accepting my job before I had resigned. Now, Murdoch wasn't entitled to fire me, because the promises made were supposed to be invigilated by eminent men called national directors. Unfortunately, the national director system didn't work. I got to them rather late in the day. They told me, the four of them, one of them had been bought off by Murdoch by giving him a job. So his independence never existed. That's the way he operates. So the other four said, "If you want to stay, you can." But Lord Robins, their leader, said to me, "But Harold, if you stay, you'll be in a straitjacket. You'll be in a lunatic asylum." Because he knew that for 3 months I'd been telling him I'd been subject to tremendous harassment by Murdoch's management. So there we are on the Tuesday budget day. I'm asked to resign. I refuse to resign. I go downstairs, and my deputy editor says, "Have you been to see him?" "Too bad, old man." And I said, "I'm not resigning." "What do you?" And he was absolutely staggered, because they expected me to leave that day. For 5 days, I did two things. I worried about it. I negotiated a settlement terms, which on the Friday were satisfactory, tried to throw me out without any compensation after all these years of service. And then I took the Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, wondering whether I should quit and whether I should, in fact, stay on. I still don't know whether I did the right thing in quitting, but the situation had become very, very unpleasant with my deputy doing a lot of politicking around the office, with Murdoch, who'd fled to New York to avoid the unpleasantness, nonetheless spreading all sorts of stories through his acolytes. And the thing which finally turned me was the feeling that I didn't want to work for him. He didn't want me, I didn't want him. The atmosphere in his office was one of vindictiveness and spitefulness. And I just thought, why the hell should I give any time or energy to him? So I quit. 7 days afterwards, on the Ides of March. It seemed appropriate.
In many respects, you got the last word in Good Times, Bad Times.
I think they're surprised, because no other editor has ever spilled the beans. The only person, if you look through Rupert Murdoch's career, is Forbes magazine, the piece this week, says, you know, editors don't survive if they stand up to him. So editors who stood up to him are not in the Murdoch employment. There's no editor in the Murdoch employment who stood up to him. Period. And Adrian Deemer in Australia, who left in similar circumstances to me because of political interference, he made a speech, but no other editors tell the story, because either they are frightened off or they sign confidentiality clauses. So I think they were surprised that I'd spilled the beans.
In fact, a columnist for the Village Voice, Jack Newfield, was here at the end of last week. And as you know, Rupert Murdoch owns the Village Voice. Was very successful.
I know the voice.
And Newfield is, by his own admission, a muckraker of the old stripe.
I know.
And he had applied some 20 years ago at the New York Post for a job, and he wasn't hired. So I asked him, I said, aren't you glad? You know, it's 20 years ago, they didn't hire you. He said, oh, yeah. He said, I'd never make it at the Post looking at it today. And I said, well, the Murdoch influence. And then all of a sudden we both realized that Murdoch, of course, was indeed responsible for the Village Voice, but he's left it alone.
Yeah.
But Newfield was not about to sit in your chair and say anything about Murdoch.
No, exactly. Now, you've got a point there. Murdoch's got two lines at the moment about me and what I've said. One line, which I think is a true line, is reflected in Forbes Business Magazine this week, where he says, editors are there to take orders. You read it. It's an obvious interview with Murdoch, and I give instructions, they must obey. That's one line. So what's Evans moaning about? This was reflected in one or two of the reviews. Time magazine, proprietors should run things. What are editors? They've got to get on with proprietors. That's one line. And that's the line which is true and honest, and at least it's not hypocritical. The other line which is hypocritical is, look, what's all this nonsense about my interfering? Look at Village Voice, I don't interfere. And I think those two lines are contradictory, and I would be very surprised if Village Voice gave a rave or a favourable review or even any space to my book. It'd be interesting.
It would be.
But they're profitable, and they are a kind of court jester for Murdoch. Like Henry VIII, the only person who could say anything rude to Henry VIII was a court jester. It didn't mean a damn thing. Everybody else had their heads chopped off if they said it, because then it meant something. So I questioned the independence of that paper in a real sense.
There's a very interesting novel that you should read if you haven't read it. It's called Winter's Tale by Mark Helprin. And in Winter's Tale, which is published by Harcourt Brace and Jovanovich, it's a fantasy in many respects. It takes place in New York City over a 100-year period. But he has a deftly drawn characterization of two newspapers in this novel. One is called The Sun, which looks very similar to the New York Times. The other is called The Ghost. The Ghost is a tabloid. The Ghost will print headlines such as, nude model sues racehorse, or dead model sues, or nude model sues dead racehorse, something like that. But there's no story. It's just the headlines, because Helprin, obviously the this is a model of the Post, Ghost Post. It's very apparent. It permeates the novel. But Helprin says people who read it don't really read it for the news stories. They'll read it for the headlines, or they'll read it for the recipes. They'll read it for the excerpts from cheap novels or movie biographies and this sort of thing. So the tabloid will print headlines that have nothing to do with anything that's inside the newspaper. It's very amusing.
No, it's very interesting. But that sounds very description, because Murdoch says that newspapers are in the entertainment business. When he published the forged Hitler diaries, and somebody said, aren't you worried about credibility? He said, no, he said, we're in the entertainment business. And the Star, his newspaper here, published the the Hitler diaries, actual diaries themselves, even after they were discovered to be forged. And Bruce Rothwell, his assistant, said to a man at the time, well, he said, look, you know, we photographed a UFO and discovered the cure for cancer and had an exclusive interview with Jesus Christ. Who's Hitler?
And we're still waiting for the killer bees.
Let me ask
you this. Murdoch is badmouthed by many people in the field of journalism who aspire to quality. And yet, Murdoch has been able to save newspapers. For example, the Post here in New York, which was never a good newspaper, and is even a worse newspaper now, seems to be relatively stable and is providing employment for a number of embarrassed people who have to admit that they work there. Hasn't he been able to do something in terms of economics to save newspapers in a world where the newspaper industry is shrinking in the light of a telecommunications explosion?
I'm not impressed by that argument in the slightest. I have two reasons why I'm not impressed by it. One, you could argue by the same token that a lot of people are employed in the whiskey business by Al Capone. I mean, I'm not suggesting that Murdoch's a gangster. But employment isn't necessarily a virtue in itself. It depends what you're employed doing, whether you're mugging old ladies or actually doing an honest day's work. And the Post represents, in many ways, a very bad influence. And I think many of Murdoch's papers do represent a bad influence because they lower the public standards of journalism. And that's a pollution of the atmosphere, which is not a good thing, however many jobs it provides. Because jobs can be provided in other ways, and good newspapers can be brought lower by the competition with the Murdoch paper. Standards get debased. It happened in Britain. The Mirror was a very fine newspaper and still is a good newspaper, but it had to lower its standards to compete with Murdoch's tit and bum sensationalism, yellow journalism and lying. So public standards are lowered by Murdoch saving newspapers, and these people who are employed by him are actually kept people there, kind of, insofar as they practice a reasonable independence, I suppose I shouldn't be too harsh on him. Secondly, it's not necessary to practice lousy journalism to save newspapers. The Sunday Times, when I was the editor of it, I think practiced good journalism, and similarly under Dennis Hamilton. It's actually has fewer sales now under Murdoch because it's lowered the quality of the paper. It's 200,000 fewer sales. And the second point is that that Murdoch, yes, does save newspapers, but they're pawns now in his game. They weren't initially. I think that his standards have got worse, frankly. They were pawns because it doesn't matter for a huge conglomerate as he is into oil, airlines, publishing, television stations, hoping to get into movies. It doesn't matter to him that one or two papers like the Post may lose a few million dollars because, one, he uses the papers for political influence, and the political influence to get an airline or avoid a monopolist commission in Britain is very useful to him. So the newspapers are kind of pawns. They're used for personal power broking. So the fact that these people are kept in employment simply to assist these larger business enterprises doesn't impress me in the least. And what worries me immensely is that if you believe in self-governing democracy, and Murdoch doesn't believe in any of that nonsense at all, you do want a decent press, but he regards the press as entertainment.
Earl Evans, we're really talking longer than I had anticipated, but I want to ask you, just throw something out at you. We talk about journalistic standards in newspapers. There are people who bemoan the day that New York had a dozen newspapers, 15 newspapers, and is down now to 3 daily newspapers, one daily newspaper, and the Daily News is not up to snuff anymore, and we know what the Post is. And yet, we look back, you mentioned yellow journalism, we look back at the turn of the century and the 20s and the 30s when the newspapers appeared to be booming, but they weren't very good newspapers.
Right.
They were, the Hearst and the Pulitzer papers were sensational newspapers. They
right.
all sought to outdo each other with stunts,
right.
with cheap thrills.
That's right.
I'm not sure that the newspaper industry has changed. It's smaller, but I'm not sure it's changed one whit, and I'm not sure that Murdoch is any different from those early press barons.
I don't think Murdoch is much different from those early press bands. Probably I don't know any of them. I mean, I know about Hearst. I think he's a little different from Hearst. You know, Hearst did many bad things, but he also did care about some crusades like landlordism in New York. Murdoch doesn't care about anything like that. I mean, and Pulitzer and the others, for all their wickedness or melodrama from time to time, did take up certain causes which weren't simply to raise circulation, but certain compassion and sympathy. He has no compassion or whatever, any of those things. He thinks that's all bullshit and so on. And secondly, partly answers the earlier question, we've seen television and radio come along, and those are very important means of giving information. So it's not necessarily the end of the world if the New York Post went out of business.
Or the Daily News.
Or the Daily News, you might say.
I think
there's maybe more integrity in the Daily News.
Oh, there is, yes. We need desperately a paper like the Times. You have to have a paper like that. But it's interesting. The people always... Well, a newspaper went out of business, or is going out of business in St. Louis. What was it, the...
Yeah, the Post-Dispatch, the Globe, yeah.
Globe?
Globe Democrat, isn't it?
Globe Democrat, I believe it. And it's going out of business. And there's a committee of employees were trying to buy it, and then there was a young outsider who was trying to move in, and there's a controversy over trying to keep it alive. In New York City, I receive on my television set 26 channels. And if I switch it over to UHF, I get a couple of extra ones, so I could probably pick up 32 television channels in my house. The New York Times list on its television page a block of radio stations. There are about 120. Admittedly, many of these are very poor in terms of gathering news. Admittedly, many are very good, such as we are extremely good. We have a fairly large staff of street reporters.
Remember.
We have about 15 street reporters, more than any other radio station in town. And because we're not a newspaper, we work more efficiently, so a reporter will cover 6-7 stories sometimes a day. So we cover a lot. And I used to worry when newspapers went out of business. And I'd worry about it less and less as I find that the void is taken up by broadcasting.
It is, and also it's taken up by different kinds of publications, too. In New York, the most exciting and interesting new thing is Clay Felker's East Side Express, a weekly newspaper.
You know, I haven't even seen that one.
Well, it's a weekly newspaper that's been going now for 3 or 4 months. It's doing extremely well. It's brilliantly put together. Clay Felker's lost the magazine New York, which he owned, and edited and invented when he was betrayed by Rupert Murdoch. And finally, Clay Felker's gone out and done something. He started a paper, and that's excellent. And that new kind of publication, a lot of breeziness, a lot of honesty, a lot of good journalism, is better than preserving the New York Post with all its corruptions.
That's true, and there are a lot of innovative things. USA Today, for example,
yeah,
is our first national paper.
You see, there's another great invention. In Chicago, they're trying to start a new paper, too. So,
and there are a lot of small things. You know, there are 4 daily Chinese language newspapers.
That's wonderful.
In this city.
It's terrific. It's fantastic.
And people don't even know it. I mean, we talk about the daily newspapers going out, but there are... And in New York, there are several Irish newspapers. One of our staff writers is the editor of a weekly Greek newspaper in English.
Yes.
It's for the Greek community. He publishes it in English, but there's also a Greek language newspaper, which is a weekly.
Yes, well, the New York Post is really a dinosaur.
Well, my last question to you, Harold Evans. What's happened to you since that momentous leaving?
Yeah.
What have you done and what are you doing now?
Well,
I
wrote the book, and I joined Goldcrest Films on Television, which is a British company making movies. We made Gandhi, we made Chariots of Fire, and I'm on the board of directors of that, and I've been looking at the possibilities, takes up where we left off, of setting up a television 24-hour news system on television for Europe, similar to CNN, and I visited the United States, and I'm here partly to continue my investigations of the prospect of doing that in about 1985 or 6. Last year, when I wasn't writing the book, I made 6 documentary films for Goldcrest, which I hope will be shown in the United States, called How We Learn to Ski. I took 3 groups of people to Europe and the United States, and I filmed what happened to them, their adventures and and how they learned and so on, and that was very enjoyable. And I've done a lot of broadcasting and other writing as well.
And you're living in London?
No, my wife's become the editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair, and I have been living in London, but now I'm inclined inclined to try and keep an eye on her.
So are you living... Are you
well, I'm living... At the moment, I'm teaching a semester at Duke University on law, ethics and the press, doing Goldcrest work, and by the end of April or May, I might be doing something else here.
So you are you making? Are you going to be making a New Yorker base now?
Depends what job I take up. If I mean, the Chicago New Papers asked me to go and edit that paper. I've said I'll be a consultant to them in the meantime. So I don't want to go to Chicago, where Rupert Murdoch is particularly, but that's a possibility. I like Chicago. That's where I was at university. I don't know.
You know, leaving the Times may have been professionally for you. A very good thing. You're doing a lot of exciting things.
Well, I'm enjoying it, and I think, well, if I hadn't left the Times, I probably wouldn't have written the book, and I'm pleased to have written the book.
I hope that your wife will do something with Vanity Fair. It certainly got off to a bad start. Richard Locke, who was the first editor, I never understood it. I couldn't figure out Vanity Fair. I still don't understand who they're talking to, and when the magazine came out, I read it. And I couldn't understand. I would go from a photograph to a poem to a short story to an article, then another photograph, then some cartoons. And it wasn't laid. I didn't have an organizational format that was clear to me.
No, well, I think she'll make a success of it. She made a success of Tatler magazine in London, which was dying, and she took it up without any reason. She had seven people on the staff. That's all. And she transformed into the fastest growing magazine in Britain.
Does she know how chancy it is working at Vanity Fair? She's the third editor.
Oh, she does know how chancy it is, and she's great confidence in Cy Newhouse and Alex Lieberman to back her, and if they back her, my judgment is that she will make a go of it. And that the Newhouse is...
But she's keeping her resume up to date.
She's keeping her resume up to date. But at the moment, she's really enjoying herself, and she's got some terrific stuff coming in the magazine, because I know she told me about it. So one way or another, I think we're going to stay in the United States.
Do you have an apartment here in New York?
She's taken a friend's apartment, and I'm down at Duke, so we've got one of these marriages now, which is every other weekend. You come here, or I go there. But we're very fond of... We're in love, obviously. And so...
Maybe you can make an appointment for next weekend.
Maybe I can go and see the editor-in-chief and see if she'd like any work done.
See if she has any openings. Just in case. Listen, exactly. It was a pleasure talking to you. I'm glad you came in. I meant to talk to you for 30 minutes. It stretched out to an hour, and...
Oh, it's been an hour, has it? It didn't seem like an hour. You've got a hell of a job editing that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's pretty well in my mind what I'm going to do with it, so I don't think I'll have too much...
Well, it's very enjoyable talking to you. Thank you, Don.